Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Welcome everybody to Season 3, Episode 16 of Cinematica. I'm Dan Slevin, and here with me in the Cinematica studio...
Hey, it's Simon here, I'm back.
I'm Kaylee, we're both back.
Yeah, everyone's going,
Yahoo! I was just going to say, who's that stranger who's sitting in the corner?
Hey.
Who are you?
Oh, I just wandered in earlier, I hope that's okay.
And you just decided to put your hand up and do a whole lot of work?
Yeah.
And go, I'm volunteering, you don't know me. Well, it is wonderful to have you both back, and
it's good to be here
in the studio, face to face. This is like the classic. This is, you know when they changed the formula for Coke, and then they had to go back to,
like vanilla
to classic Coke. This is classic Coke, ladies and gentlemen.
Classic
here with the Cinematica.
Get away from my Coke.
Except it's a bit warm today.
Yeah, a bit warm. Warm flat Coke.
Yeah.
In today's episode of the show. The heavyweight championship of world movies gets underway this week as the Oscar contenders come out swinging. Daniel Day-Lewis plays Lincoln for Steven Spielberg, and Silver Linings Playbook has a contender in all four acting nominations for the Oscars this year. That's a pretty rare thing. We'll also go to France for two different examples of some father-son rivalry, and we have a guest reviewer on the show this week, Beth Brash from eatandgreet.co.nz. But first, Kaylee, what's in our mailbag? Have people been sending us two-word reviews for Celeste and Jesse Forever? Because it's not playing here in Wellington. It's the only way we're going to be able to feature it on the show.
It is playing in Wellington?
Is it?
Yes, it is.
Where?
Yeah, it's
where?
Playing up at the penthouse.
The penthouse.
Well, it's not on Flix, which is where I was looking. So
I don't always trust Flix.
You've always just, you know, everyone talks about social media websites and stuff, but you know what? Just go to the newspaper. Just open the page. It's right there in front of you.
But isn't the penthouse one of those cinemas that actually only advertises in the paper on sort of Friday and Saturday? It's like, are they one of those that's just dropped their daily listings?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, actually.
I don't know.
But that's why
I don't trust the newspaper anymore, because sometimes you go to the paper and nobody's advertising in it.
Did anyone look on the penthouse website?
Well, I saw it in the paper.
I'm chagrined at this. So that's now two or three weeks that I've missed reviewing them for my paper, the Capital Times, because I just assumed that it wasn't playing anywhere. So if you're listening in penthouse land, feel free to drop me a note every now and then if you think you'd like me to review something that you're playing, because you can't necessarily rely on me getting fully accurate information.
No, they will, I'm sure now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Okay, so apologies to them and to Celeste and to Jesse.
And our...
But we haven't covered it on the show. And the general public.
Yeah.
So did anybody fire through any reviews of Celeste and Jesse so that we can at least acknowledge its existence?
Several, actually. I was a bit confused because I didn't see your tweet asking for those reviews, and I was like, what is all this stuff? So in sequential tweets, Stuart review of Celeste and Jesse is wasted talent. Geekboy73 says indie quirk, cute pick. So two-word reviews.
Ooh.
Not bad. Kelly Dare says endearing F-ups or hopeful heartbreak.
Oh, that's another two-word review.
Yes, and Sakura59 says uncomfortably relatable.
Excellent.
So that's just a taste of some of the two-word reviews we got for Celeste and Jesse.
I will get to it on the weekend, and if it hasn't finished, and I will report back on the next show. So that's that. I'm just going through my to-do list, actually, of stuff that we need to sort of cover. A couple of weeks ago, we mentioned, we were talking about Rust and Bone. You reviewed it for us, didn't you, Kaylee, based on your Canadian experience.
And at
the time, we were not sure if it was going to be released here in New Zealand. And in the meantime, a release date has appeared. 18th of March, am I
maybe
right?
Maybe they listen to our show.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe maybe I convinced
it's
them.
It's something like that. It's either the 18th
or 28th. 28th. 28th of yeah, March. It had an yeah, 8 in it. It God, did. We're not doing yeah, very well with like facts, are we?
No, no, no. You just you come to me and I'll sort you out.
Okay. 28th of March for Rust and Bone. And some more corrections, because, you know, last
week... There's a bit of shifting going on.
Last week, I said quite a few things that turned out to be, like, not even remotely accurate, one of which was that Johnny Greenwood should win the Oscar for best score for The Master, and he's not actually even nominated, which is, like, a complete... I guess I could not imagine why they wouldn't nominate him, so I didn't even bother doing any research on that. And also, I got the name of Quentin Tarantino's former editor... Sally Menke, who passed away and who didn't, because she died, didn't get a chance to work on Django Unchained. So apologies to people who I misled on that basis. So that's that business out of the way. Have you got anybody else feedback to us?
Yeah, I'm half asleep. I'm a bit jet lagged.
Are you jet lagged still?
I am.
When did you get back?
I got back on Saturday morning.
That's ages ago.
I know. When I went over, it took about a week to get over it. It's less about... Actually, it's being tired here, but there I was awake, but I couldn't eat at the right times. So I had, like, stomach jet lag. It was terrible.
Plus, you know, she went through the trauma of going from the winter to then standing out on the beach on Sunday and getting, you know, saying hello to the sun.
Sunburn, yeah. So I think I'm just, like, mentally slow from the sunburn.
Yeah, so you've been in the wars.
Yeah.
It's so hard being you.
Oh, I know.
International travel.
Sunburn.
Yeah. As I walked in the door of Cinematica Towers this afternoon, I noticed that it is actually hot
Twin
enough
towers.
that the tarmac is melting outside.
Really?
So it's just, you know, a sign. You know, Wellington doesn't often get that warm.
No, it's been pretty warm all over.
No, so make sure you
take a break and go to the movies.
Yeah. Go to the movies.
Air conditioned
cool. Cinemas.
Yeah.
Check something out.
It's dangerous. That sun is dangerous, people.
Because going head to head with the sun this weekend is a lot of films.
Yeah.
A lot of good films.
Yes. let's one more tweet.
Take that
that's all we have time
let's
for.
Let's get one more.
Take that sun.
Robert Caddo, who's now in Australia, in Sydney, said Contiki Film, which is opening in April, May, looks like May. Norwegian wood, as in, isn't it good?
Contiki. Yes, I've heard some really good things about Contiki, and it's good to know that it's got a date. Yes. So, bearing in mind that at least in Wellington, it's been unseasonably hot. we actually have had, what, 4 or 5 days of sun in a row, which is just unheard of here.
It is.
What have people been going to at the movies? What's our top five?
Ah, so this week, sitting at 5 is The Hobbit, which is down from number 4.
What's that clocked?
How much money?
Yeah. 10 or 11?
Is it into 8 figures?
Use my finger to go across the page. Whoa, just over $11 million.
Yeah. That's pretty good,
isn't
it?
Just in New Zealand.
It's pretty good.
Okay.
Opening at number 4 was The Impossible. In 3, down from 2, Life of Pi. In 2, down from 1, Les Mis. And sitting at number 1 is Django Unchained.
That's a very interesting outcome for a Tarantino film to go straight in at number 1.
And also,
I thought it was a bit of an acquired taste for New Zealanders.
I think there's
a lot of hype around it.
Yeah, a lot of hype and excitement, and maybe the holidays helps a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. I don't remember Inglourious Bastards being that big at the box office.
No, but
so
what was the time of year?
Yeah,
of that
that's
one?
True.
You know, I just wonder if that slightly younger audience has got good access to it. You know, not younger than 16, of course.
Yeah,
but you know.
And the biggest shift this week was Gangster Squad went from 3 to 6.
Whoa! Word of mouth.
Yep.
Doing its job.
The ladies have gone, it's over.
Yeah, that's it. The Gosling magic is...
I don't believe that.
Well, okay, he's got a few more coming out this year, so we'll see. We shall track. We shall have the Gosling index.
The Gosling meter.
I like the Gosling index.
Index.
Wow.
We shall be reviewing that as the year goes on. Time to get into some serious... And this is a very, very serious film, everybody.
We here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain. That this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom. That government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
We can't tell our people they can vote yes on abolishing slavery unless at the same time we can tell them that you're seeking a negotiated peace.
It's either the amendment or this Confederate peace. You cannot have both.
How many hundreds of thousands have died during your administration?
Congress must never declare equal those whom God created unequal.
Oh, golly, there's lots of speechifying going on in Steven Spielberg's Lincoln. Daniel Day-Lewis plays the president of the United States, possibly the greatest president that the United States has ever had. Certainly the one that's like got the most mythic sort of stature, or maybe apart from
George Washington. Biggest statue.
And the biggest statue, yeah.
He's in everyone's pockets.
Well, that's true too. So, Sai, you are our U.S. political history correspondent for today.
Well, who's seen it?
We've all seen it.
Yeah. You've all seen it.
Yeah. Come on, bring it on.
I'm not the specialist as such, but, you know, hey, I haven't seen the other ones. This will do. It's interesting because it's actually quite, when you break it down, it's actually quite close to sort of like the state of government in the US at the moment, in the sense that there's this gridlock, there's this kind of division and this inability to push things through and significant attempts, you know, like Medicare, to sort of get things through in opposition to them.
I thought it was very up to date, actually, in that the whole idea of the balance of power and the three different arms of government, and, you know, this is what the founding fathers of America intended. It's actually working the way it was intended to do. You know, nobody can take control.
Well, but, you know, this is all about how Lincoln does take control, and how he manipulates, and how he leverages off certain people, and there's even hints at sort of, you know, bribes when he actually decides, at the point at which he decides that he is going to try and abolish slavery and get the 13th Amendment in play and all that sort of thing, that the amount of work and lobbying that goes on. And it's really interesting because you look at that and go, well, gee, you know, there's a template for today. I mean, the whole sort of lobbying concept and everything that goes on in the film is no different now, just bigger and bolder. In a lot of ways, it's a simple story in that it's about how he's trying to, you know, scare up these votes to get this legislation across the line. And of course, you know, it's a very lofty goal that he has, and a very significant piece of legislation. It's not, you know, I'm not saying it's a comparable thing to Medicare and those sorts of things, but it is. There are some sort of comparisons to today, which I thought was really interesting.
I thought it was also really interesting was the number of people who were opposed to the legislation, were opposed to the amendment, but were anti-slavery. And so he seemed to, again, this is politics in a nutshell. Mm. He seemed to spend an enormous amount of time trying to win over people who were already on his side.
Oh, completely, yeah. Completely. And they were so far off. Initially, they were so far off the mark in terms of the votes that they needed. Mm. The piece that you had at the start there, you know, in the slow piano sort of playing away. I mean, that is the pace of the film on the whole. I mean, it starts with a terrific kind of almost a Private Ryan type opening with the warfare that takes place, but then it really just settles down into this slow, pacey
clash of ideas. And people really sort of taking some time to get these ideas, to really elucidate these ideas and get these ideas out. Lincoln himself is a fascinating character because you can tell that he's got these very lofty, he's very idealistic. There's a long speech that he gives which is brilliant, where he talks about what he did with the Proclamation of Emancipation very early on in the Civil War, doubting whether what he did was even legal. You know, and that's why the 13th Amendment was so important. He freed the slaves with the emancipation, but this is a complex idea to get your head around. And I imagine, you know, that lawyers would appreciate the fact that he winds up arguing all sides in that one speech, and you get to the point where you can see how much he wrestles with the clash of his own idealism and the practical necessity of what it takes to get things done. And also, of course, the thousands of people who are dying on the battlefield.
Well, and that's one of the points in the film, is that there is a certain, you know, segment of government there that just wants the war to end and as quickly as possible. And if that means sort of coming up with a compromise and not, you know, not abolishing slavery, then that was fine. And he had to navigate through that level of opposition, as well as, you know, very strong religious opposition that African Americans just didn't figure, you know, that they just weren't on the same level as them and therefore shouldn't be included. You know, and that's not just religious, but across all sorts of political sort of boundaries, there's that view, and it's very, very strong. And it's interesting, I think we were talking about it before, that there isn't actually that much, there aren't that many characters represented who are African American, and I guess that's, you know, in a way that's sort of reflective of the time, and that these are decisions that are being made in a way on their behalf. Even though it does open very strongly, recognizing the troops that are fighting and so on, who were of African American sort of, you know, origins, which I thought was, you know, a good way to start it. But it doesn't. It does for me. It does have a pace where you have to sit and really kind of concentrate and relax, and really kind of try to soak it up and absorb it. If you go into this film in a hurry or other things on your mind, then I think you're not kind of doing it justice. It is a film where you need to take your time and just let it roll all over you and really absorb it.
And take a little bit of time to appreciate its strengths rather than concentrating on its weaknesses. Kaylee, what did you think?
I saw this as a double feature with Wreck-It Ralph, so it wasn't the best setup for it to be enjoyed. Although I enjoyed the performances. I thought Sally Field was wonderful. Really great, sort of like snappy first wife. I'm not sure about Joseph Gordon-Levitt. A lot of people like him in the film, but I find he's just so big right now. He kind of stole the scene too much, and he was quite distracting.
Just by his presence.
Yeah,
I didn't think there was anything that he did wrong necessarily.
No, it was he was a bit. I mean, of course, it's a star-studded cast, but it's a star-studded cast who's like a much more mature star-studded cast, and then Joseph Gordon-Levitt comes in as like this hot young thing, and he's like, blah, blah, blah. So I've wrestled with this a bit, whereas it wasn't super engaging, but it was intelligent, it was well made, and I think it was a good representation, or, you know, more of I guess a romanticized representation of the time. I'm not so much a fan of Spielberg films anymore. Like his name used to be one that's like, yeah, that's going to be a good film, but he's just kind of taken on these much more like War Horse. He's like slow, romantic, manly man crush films, and it's just blah.
I thought that this was actually a return to form from a Spielberg point of view. I thought that the stuff that he's been doing most recently with that sort of gentle levitating camera that just gently moves in and out, like there's lots of slows, I mean it's all slow, isn't it, but there's lots of slow zooms or slow steady cam shots moving through a crowd. I just felt like there was an effortlessness about the direction that it's not showy, but he just sort of knows when to direct your attention at a particular performance or a particular face. And it just seemed to me that this was somebody who obviously knows what they're all about and doesn't have anything to prove.
Yeah, there's a confidence about it. And you're right, there isn't anything to prove. And I tend to lean into your side, Dan, in that I found it, you know, really, I mean, here's a film that is very, very confident in the way that it's made. It's just that, you know, for the subject matter, it's tough, and it's not a universal sort of subject. You know, very strong in the US, and you'd expect it to be so.
And yet it sort of should be. Like, this is not that long ago. I was talking to somebody earlier on this week about this film, and I mentioned that I'd seen video on YouTube of an old guy appearing on an American game show in the mid-1950s who was a witness to Lincoln's assassination. You know, like, we're not talking many generations ago. And the person I was talking to said, well, you know, of course, there are recordings of Lincoln's voice. You know, so we're talking about something that was slavery that was unspeakable. And yet it's not that long ago that we were still having to argue that it shouldn't exist.
Oh, sure.
I think that stuff's important to remember.
Yeah, sure. But it's so entrenched in American history. I mean, you look at the race relations of the 1960s and so on. I mean, these are big issues that seem to, I think, resonate really strongly in the US. And this is a topic that it'll be interesting to see. It'll be interesting to see how it opens around the rest of the world. I mean, I think it'll do well. I just don't know if it'll, it'll still probably box, above it. I mean, it'll do strongest business in the US. Yeah. So,
The international versions of the film actually have a few extra captions at the beginning because they don't. The international distributors don't trust that audiences will even know who Lincoln was and what he did.
I wouldn't go that far. Yeah, certainly not in markets like New Zealand or Australia.
Yeah, perhaps.
I actually, it's funny when you look at that and you think about something like Django, which is essentially another film about race, very clearly it is,
And slavery
and
itself.
And how he kind of goes about it. And then you look at how Spielberg goes on it.
I think they make a fantastic double feature.
They are. I think that would be a really sort of interesting. And I've got to say, for me when I watched Django at the time, it's a long film, but it didn't feel like it. Mm. Lincoln at times, it does feel like it. Because you're really concentrating, I think also because the accents are quite heavy. Mm. And you're really kind of having to concentrate to sort of take in the dialogue. But, it is probably clearly it's a film that's worthy of the praise it's getting.
Talking of praise, let's talk about Daniel Day-Lewis for a moment, because
he's stunning.
I was watching him in this and thinking, everybody else should just go home now. All the other contenders for Best Actor, it's like they've been dancing around the ring, waiting for their chance, and then the real heavyweight champion comes out of the dressing room, and it's like, oh bugger. is there any doubt that he isn't the most talented screen actor of his generation? He's just so in command.
Well, it's also, I think with him, it's almost like less is best. I mean, he doesn't work when he doesn't want to. Yeah, that's right. He's very clear about the films he's going to make, and I think that that really kind of keeps him in high esteem for a very long time, doesn't it? I mean, I love to watch him on the screen, and I will go and watch a film if he's in it. There are a lot of others who are probably very good actors, but they're just too overplayed. They're just too in the market too much, So I mean, I think he's awesome, and he's really, I mean, he is, yeah, you're right, he's gonna, well, barring sort of some sort of scandal, he's gonna get the Oscar for Best Actor.
He is.
And I thought the way he carried off, the way he sort of tells, the storytelling in the film and things like that, which are just, they're kind of mesmerizing, those little sort of cheeky stories that he tells at times. And when he actually does get angry and bangs the table, I think he's just so incredibly powerful. So I'm not sure if it's going to be everyone's cup of tea, but I think it's going to do solid. It's going to get solid sort of attendance.
Yeah. Well, it's getting a big recommendation from me. Should we go around the table now for two words?
Mm-hmm.
Have we had a chance to prepare?
I did. So my two-word review for Lincoln is capital performance.
Nice. Capital performance.
I went with moral courage.
Excellent work. My two words for Lincoln, civics lesson.
Yeah, good.
All right.
Nice.
I'm scared.
I know. I'm scared too. But do you know the most scary bit for me?
When the water hit?
No. After that, when I came up. That was all on my own. That was the scariest part. And then I saw the two of you clinging to the tree, and I didn't feel so scared anymore because I knew I wasn't on my own, you see? Well, what if Mummy and Lucas are on their own right now? Imagine how scared they'll be.
We'll look for them together.
No. Thomas, you have to look after Simon, and I'm going to keep looking for them.
All right. The Impossible, which is based on a true story about a family caught up in the Asian tsunami in 2004, Boxing Day. They were on holiday in Thailand. And the original family, the family that it's based on, are Spanish. And the film itself is a Spanish movie, but in order to get it made, I think a little bit of star power was required. And so the parents are played by Naomi Watts and Ewan McGregor. That was Ewan McGregor there in that clip from the film. And this is a film that I think, Sia, you've been a little scornful of.
I wouldn't
you?
Say that. No, I wouldn't say that.
No, but maybe we wouldn't go that far. But you haven't actually seen it yet, have you?
No, I haven't. And no. The thing for me is, I'm not sure I want to. I just find the topic really tough. I wouldn't want to. I mean,
you have children of your own.
Yeah, that's right. I got kids of my own, and I just find that sort of thing. I would find it quite tough. And I that's my question
about
to you.
About the same age as well, actually.
Yeah, okay. And that's my question to you. In that sense, is how we? I mean, I suspect this is a tough film that won't leave a dry eye in the house.
Well. I can tell you that it's bloody good, right?
Really?
And this is what I was not expecting.
Does not make it look good.
No, I know. And there's another film coming up that has a trailer that doesn't do it any favours as well. But this is one where possibly of all the films on this summer, it was the one I was looking forward to least and probably put off seeing for as long as I could. And the first sort of 5 or 10 minutes when you're being introduced to the family, it's sort of very much by numbers, and you think, well, these people are pretty annoying, It's like a disaster movie, isn't it?
Like
you
can't the Poseidon
wait
or something.
You can't. Yeah. You can't wait for them to be for disaster to strike.
Hmm.
But there was a bit of muttering around in the cinema. There was a bit of talking, a bit of rustling, and all that sort of annoyance. And then the tsunami strikes, and nobody said a word for the rest of the film. It was absolutely gripping. It is very, very powerful. The tsunami sequence is extremely difficult to watch, and I would imagine if you've got sort of phobias about that sort of stuff, about natural disasters, and if you've lived through earthquakes and what have you, I imagine something like this would be extremely difficult to watch. Very, very well made, very well edited, and you just... horrifying. It is as horrifying as any horror movie. That sequence goes on for maybe about 15 minutes, and then the rest of the film is about the family's search for each other. They're separated, and they end up in hospitals or in Red Cross camps, and it is very, very well done. Very, very moving. As you said, that if you've got kids around that age, you will totally buy the performances of the kids and of the adults involved, and the extraordinary stress that they were under. It does focus on this one family, and there really isn't very much sort of mention of the indigenous population, but it doesn't shy away from the fact that there was an enormous loss of life. It's clear that the survivors, no matter how bashed up and damaged psychologically and physically they are the lucky ones. And I think that this is a film that you're absolutely right. I think people couldn't fail to be moved by it, and it was a big surprise for me. I thought it was a terrifically well made film. Watts and McGregor are brilliant in it, and the kids are just fantastic as well, and it really does sweep you along with it, and you have to be reminded that it's a true story, because the coincidences at the end are so extraordinary that you think, no, it couldn't possibly happen. But it pays to be reminded that it is one single beautiful redemptive story in an ocean of awfulness. I think I'm possibly the only one around the table that's seen it. Well, I do recommend you go, even though it will be difficult.
Yeah, it's quite tough because it is. I think also it's come out at such a time when there are just so many other films around, and in some ways, with a bit more room to move, you could imagine the film
being
a lot stronger or doing a lot more, performance-wise.
Well, it wasn't a bad house that I was that I watched it with yesterday, and that was a Tuesday night, so maybe Cheap Tuesday drew a few people out. But I think I think it is finding an audience, and I hope that there's enough screen space around for it to maybe play out.
Yeah, make it through the next few weeks, because that's going to be the question, isn't it? Is I mean, with like so many films. six films opening over the next like 10 days. It's going to be interesting to see.
Right, so my two words for The Impossible are feelings multiplied. Time for some news.
Some lovely big words in the news today.
And not only that, some foreign language for you. I love finding some interesting long names for you to pronounce.
In the words of Samuel L. Jackson in Jurassic Park, hold on to your butts.
Hold on to your butts.
The relentless prognostication around award season is terribly dreary, but the French César Awards nominations announced this week make for interesting reading. 9 nominations for The Amazing Holy Motors catches the eye, but the leading contender looks like Benoît Jacquot's costume epic Farewell My Queen with 11. Nominees for Best Foreign Film include Argo and The Angel's Share.
Which is bewildering, isn't it? Of all the millions of films that the French could have chosen for their best foreign language César, The Angel's Share. Really? I mean, it's all right, but no, that's quite perplexing. Perplexing.
It is foreign language, that's for sure.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's right. It meets that category.
Warner Brothers is under new management as Kevin Sugihara takes the reins as CEO. Sugihara's background isn't in movie or television production. However, it is in home entertainment, including DVD downloads and video games.
And
so we can see where that's going.
And pundits. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Pundits have recognized that. Apart from the fact that he was a sort of compromise contender for the job because the two leading executives at Warner Brothers who run the cinema division, the motion picture division, and the television division there was talk at one point that they were going to share the job or something because they're the two sort of top dogs. What Warner Brothers has done is they've gone over their heads and appointed somebody else, and there may be yet more executive defections at Warner Brothers, but they're definitely pinning their money on home entertainment as for the future.
Did you get an answer on your CV? Did they write back?
No, they didn't even get the opportunity to have a Skype interview.
Oh, that's wrong.
I know. Well, look, their loss.
I know. We know what to do. We know.
All right. Now we're going to take a little bit of a break from Oscar and award contending films, and there are still a few indies being released into New Zealand cinemas, even though there's such a lot of competition. This is the first of two films today about father-son conflict.
Vous savez, c'est important. Le Marcel, c'est 11 générations sans interruption.
Il y a de la lumière dans ça.
On pourrait faire une photo devant le château, le père, le fils.
Non, merci.
J'espère que Martha arrivera à me faire un petit-fils.
Et pourquoi il n'y arriverait pas?
Il a quand même mis 20 ans pour faire une phrase sans bégayer.
Ratez jamais une occasion, hein.
Contrairement à vous, la vigne est sans pitié. Je
peux m'occuper des vinifs et des vendanges avec toi.
Toi?
Oui, j'ai fait une école.
All right, this is You Will Be My Son, which is a drama, I guess you'd call it. It's certainly not there's no comedy in it. It's a melodrama, probably more than just a drama, about a father, an irascible, grumpy father who owns a vineyard in the south of France, and he's incredibly proud of its long history of producing fine wines, and he's concerned, well, not as much concerned, his son, who has gone off to university to study viticulture and to study the production of wine, has come back into the business, and when the chief winemaker for the company falls ill, looks like he won't be able to supervise the harvest and the vintage and the making of the next vintage, the son puts his hand up and says, well, you know, I've studied all this, why don't I do it for you? And the dad, who's, I'm just looking up on IMDb right now, this is called You Will, excuse me, Be My Son. The dad just goes, no, bugger off, you useless bugger.
nice work.
Pretty much.
That last
yeah, that's bugger. My trans. That's my translation of the French. And
could you say in French now?
No. Okay. I'll tell you who plays the father. Niels Aristrup, and not a name that will be familiar with many of, but you'll know his face. Did you ever see a film called Un Prophète?
Yes.
Yeah, well, he was the old gangster.
The old gangster.
and definitely somebody you don't want to mess with, basically. What happens is that the son of the ailing winemaker comes back from California. He's apparently been making wine for Coppola. Comes back to look after his dad, and the old guy, the owner, basically sort of decides to adopt him in favor of his instead of his son. Real son. It's an awful person, and that's the big problem that this film has, really, is that they're all awful people, and you just want them just to shut up, really.
Sounds a bit like Footnote.
There wasn't a lot of likable. Yeah, you're right.
Father versus son.
Yeah, and it wasn't very likable, was it? Footnote. It was kind of comic in places.
That had the benefit of having some really wonderful. Humor in it. This is just tough. It's adapted from a novel, and it sort of feels a little bit like it. And it really does amp up the melodrama quite a lot by the end. You know, there's car crashes, and by the end of it,
turns out someone was just asleep the whole time.
Not quite as drastic as that, but it is. It's a tough old watch, and the performance by Niels Aristrup is pretty good. But the son, you just want to shake him, and I don't know whether that's just the character or the performance or what. But this one, I did have a few problems with, I have to say. And, you know, there are a lot of other options around at the moment, so it's a bit hard to say, you know. Films about wine, do they tend to play in New Zealand, Simon?
Not since Sideways.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been a couple of films that, you know, had wine as central to the theme, but they haven't kind of fired in the same way.
Yeah, and because it's not really about wine as such, you know. It's just about this awful family dynamic, and it's just so kinda hard to get into.
It's kind of like a romantic idea of where to place it, isn't it? It's just placed it amongst the vineyards. You know,
yeah, exactly. So there's a lot of beautiful photography in it, and it's also very French, right? So there's great French tradition, so you can sort of understand what the pressures that are involved.
Imagine something like The Hobbit set on a vineyard. You must go to the Pinot Noir grapes. Something like that, you know, and find the ring of so-and-so.
Well, you know, the vintner's luck, you could argue.
Yeah, it'd be kind of crazy, like, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Let's get that on YouTube.
I thought I was the one who was dying. What's going on?
All right.
Just a zany idea.
So, I suppose I should sum up.
It's getting really hot, though, isn't it?
It is getting really hot in here.
It's like a sauna.
I suppose I should come up with two words for son. And
just so you listeners know at home, we're all shimmering a little bit at the moment.
We're glowing.
Glowing. Natural glow. Hey, come on now, give us two words.
Two words for this. Dreary melodrama.
Oh.
Dreary melodrama for You Will Be My Son. So not a recommend, unfortunately. But we've got another film opening in the same week, also about father and son conflict. But this one, however, is a documentary.
Non, ce qui me plaît, c'est que ça a du sens, mais bon, faut le piger, le sens, là.
Arrête de regarder, mange. Ça se mange, la cuisine.
Oui, mais ça se regarde d'abord.
Moi, j'aurais mis ma purée là, comme ça. Moi, j'aurais collé mon foie gras là.
And joining us on the line, semi-live, here on Cinematica, is Beth Brash, who is the publisher and owner, producer of one of the best food and restaurant blogs in New Zealand, Eat and Greet.
Oh.
Is that too much?
No, say what you like.
It's eatandgreet.co.nz, am I right?
That's right.
Brilliant. And so you're now stepping in to be our specialist food film reviewer, and you can let us know a little bit about how accurately these movies about restaurants and chefs and the great chefs of Europe, how they translate to real life. We're going to talk about Step Up to the Plate, which is a documentary film about the renowned French chef Michel Bras, depending on where you went to school. And he is one of those three Michelin-starred chefs, a legend the world over. But it's about time for him to retire. And his son, Sebastian, who has been working with his dad for 15 years, is about to take over the family restaurant. And it's not just the restaurant. They own a hotel as well in the south of France. It's a hotel that looks like an ocean liner.
I think that one's in Japan.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay. Yeah. I'm getting a little bit confused.
They've got one in their sort of, the original one that's in France. But because I looked it up afterwards, and they've got I think it's part of a hotel, and then there's a cooking school and part of that.
All right. How would you describe the food that he is responsible for? Like, is it what I used to think of as like nouvelle cuisine?
Yeah, that sort of. I mean, at one point he does put. I mean, there is other things on the plate, but at one point he does put a singular pea on that plate, and I had a little chuckle to myself. But it is pretty incredible food. It's sort of artwork. It depends what you're into. I mean, if you're looking for sort of good, hearty, comfort food, it's probably not wouldn't be your cuisine of choice. But it's, there's a lot of thought put into it. And you can see that in the film, they kind of, throughout the film, they sort of, Sebastian, who's taking over his son, you see him kind of develop this dish, which is quite amazing to watch and see the kind of iterations it goes through. And then also you see this really lovely moment with his grandma where she does a very simple sort of version of that dish, and you sort of see where it's all come from.
Yeah, because the family is extremely important. There are multiple generations involved in the film, and you get this sense of that the extraordinary cuisine that Michel Bras has created is really just an amazing sort of iteration of what he grew up with. This isn't sort of molecular cuisine, is it? This isn't all done with vacuum flasks and test tubes.
No. There's lots of smears and sort of powders and things, but it's nothing. Yeah, there's no kind of dry ice or anything like that.
No, I was very taken with butternut spaghetti. I thought that was...
Yeah.
I was quite keen to sample that, but
so simple, isn't it? Like, you know, that's the other thing is at the sort of one of the starting for the images, there's where they sort of they create plates, and it's essentially just loads of fresh herbs and loads of fresh vegetables and flowers and that sort of thing, and at the end it kind of just looks like this incredible garden. And there's no real cooking involved, but...
Assembly.
But no, he obviously, you know, like you see him at the market, and he obviously knows what's good and what's not. And so there is, you know, there's so much skill there, and it's not just about the cooking. It's just about knowing taste and knowing what's good.
I wanted to ask you about that market scene, actually, because... And you hang around restaurateurs and chefs a lot because of Eat and Greet, and it's something that I've never quite understood. How is it that they get to get up so early in the morning so that they're there at the market for the fresh stuff before it's dawn? And how is it that they're still able to be up at night supervising the kitchen till whenever? I don't understand. Like, do they sleep in the middle of the day? Chefs just have amazing freaks. Fortitude. They're freaks.
I mean, you meet a chef, and I mean, there's Jake. I know Jacob, who works out at the Larder. He gets up at 4 a.m. every morning and makes brioche, and then and then you go down to the market, and then you you prep for the day, and then you cook all night. It's just, it's that scary thing called passion, and, and it just, that takes over more than anything else, more than sleep. I don't have that. I just want to eat it.
Fair enough, too. Fair enough. And photograph it and interview them. The big tension, and it's not really that much tension, is there? I mean, it's not like there's a massive drama going on here, but the big tension is Sebastian actually ready to take over? And how did you feel? What did you, I mean, obviously a lot of pressure.
And the thing, there's what I really loved about it is that you can just feel that pressure, and you can see the weight of the world on that guy's shoulders. And there's just these incredible shots where there's a lot of amazing solitary shots of him just like running, you know, in winter and things like that. And he just sort of stands there, and there's just, it just lingers on him, and you can just feel it, that, you know, this poor guy. And I don't know, there's just the moments between him and his dad. And I wonder if also Michelle is kind of messing with him a little bit, you know, is he just kind of always just second guessing him and trying to, you know, that, and just so that he's always thinking and that sort of thing, because he's, you know, he's really harsh, and he makes this incredible dish, and pretty much his dad just spends the whole time, you know, picking it apart, and you know, your heart's breaking for the guy. But it's interesting to watch.
Mm.
And I think, you know, but he obviously does have it.
Yeah, I think so. And the question is Michelle, his dad, a one off, like, or is Sebastian, once he comes out from the shadow, is he going to take it in a completely different direction? Is he going to become his own man? We were talking before we started recording this conversation about Jiro Dreams of Sushi and the similarities there with a son sort of. Sort of struggling to find his own voice in that shadow. And do you feel that this film is as good as that as the Sushi film?
There's less food porn in this one, and it's more kind of focusing on Sebastian and his. And, you know, and feeling, you can, you know, just focusing on him and feeling that pressure and that sort of thing. Whereas Jiro Dreams of Sushi, it was more about Jiro and, you know, him letting go and that sort of thing. So, and I felt more with Jiro, there was this, oh my God, can he do it? Can he take it over? Whereas with this one, you kind of feel like, you know, I feel like, oh yeah, you've got this.
Yeah, yeah, just get on with it. Tell your dad to bugger off and go and go and ride his bike in the forest somewhere, and leave the kitchen to me. I've got this, Dad.
Yeah, but there's, you know, there's just, the thing I loved about Step Up to the Plate was those scenes of just, you know, there are these just incredible slow scenes, very solitary scenes, you know, a lot of the countryside and everything like that. So in a way, I feel like it'll appeal to a bigger audience than, say, something like Jiro Dreams of Sushi, which may be a bit more kind of just for the foodies. There's maybe more sort of human drama.
All right. Beth Brash, thanks very much for your time, and your writing on food in Wellington can be found at eatandgreet.co.nz.
Thank you.
I feel motivated. I don't feel so angry all the time.
The whole time you're rooting for this Hemingway guy to survive the war and to be with the woman that he loves.
It's 4 o'clock in the morning, Pat.
I can't apologize. I will apologize on behalf of Ernest Hemingway, because that's who's to blame here.
Yeah, have Ernest Hemingway call us and apologize to us, too.
Bad. You have to have a strategy.
I hate my illness, and I want to control it.
I hope you're okay with Veronica's sister coming over.
Tiffany and Tommy?
Just Tiffany.
What happened to Tommy?
He died.
How'd he die?
Please, don't bring it up.
Hey, Tiffany. This is Pat.
You look nice.
Thank you.
How'd Tommy die?
Silver Linings Playbook. This is a film that the trailer's been playing for quite a long time, hasn't it? And
yep.
I have to say that if there was an Oscar... to be given out for the most misleading trailer ever, Silver Linings Playbook would be right up there, because this is a film that doesn't even look like the trailer. You know, it's like it's got a kind of indie grit to it, the actual film, that was never there in the trailer. The trailer looked like a glossy romantic comedy. Who's going to be our mental health correspondent?
Me.
Our Philadelphia mental health correspondent.
Yes, thank you. Well, Silver Linings Playbook, if you haven't heard already, haven't watched the trailer and don't know what it's about, it stars Bradley Cooper and Jennifer Lawrence, as well as a lovely Jackie Weaver with a fantastic accent, and Robert De Niro. Bradley Cooper just gets out of a stint at a mental institution after a total breakdown and losing everything, including his wife, and has come back to Philly, was picked up by his mother prematurely from the institution, and is trying to get back together with his wife and get his life back together, and meets Jennifer Lawrence, who recently lost her husband in some sort of police incident.
Spoilers.
No. And so they... they sort of hit it off and are at war and at odds, but end up sort of coming together in this interesting way and bonding over their mental illness.
Yeah, and ballroom dancing.
Yes.
It's two different films, and it changes halfway through, and it starts off being a kind of gritty indie, slightly comedy drama about, you know, living with mental illness, and then it turns into just, I think, a real sort of a really well made, but basically a really conventional boilerplate romantic comedy, and you know the final act we could have seen, I don't know, dozens and dozens of times. I think it's quite well done, the way it concludes. It helps that you've got to know these characters reasonably well, and you're sort of rooting for them, as you should be, in a romantic comedy. But I was surprised at what a conventional turn it took, you know. So have you seen it?
Not quite.
Oh, not quite. I think that means no.
It does. Isn't it? But I it's definitely one I've got lined up to see. Well, given all the critical acclaim.
Yeah, there's nominations for all four acting awards at the Oscars, and I think possibly not with that much justification, to be honest. I have a bit of a Bradley Cooper problem.
Well, you know what? I had a Bradley Cooper problem until I watched on holiday Wet Hot American Summer and this. I didn't like Bradley Cooper, and now I do.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's... Well, he's the question mark for me, because she's amazing. I always like to watch her. So I want to see how he pulls it off. In the much the same way I wanted to know how Russell Crowe pulled it off in Les Mis.
Apparently he didn't.
Okay.
That's what I've heard.
Oh, I can't say that. Yeah, so I'm looking forward to it, actually. It's one of my sort of the ones I'm going to rush out and see. Probably, hopefully, this weekend.
I think that it's a crowd pleaser.
It's a David O. Russell film as well.
Yes,
this
indeed.
This is a good director.
And a reasonable screenwriter as well. Like I really like The Fighter, which was his most recent film, and that I thought transcended its subject matter, and I thought actually had quite a lot of depth to it. This, I think, gives you the impression that there's going to be depth, and then nothing actually appears, which is a bit of a disappointment.
It's a bit nice, because you go into a film... It is about a difficult subject matter that is difficult for some people to talk about, but you do get rewarded, and in the end you don't feel bad, and you don't feel like you've watched a really heavy film.
You haven't been through the ringer.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Whereas The Fighter, you're like, whoa, that was great, but whoa. So yeah. this is kind of that, you know, fighter, heavy film, something a bit lighter.
As the credits rolled, I thought that the romantic comediness of it was its strongest aspect, and because we've had some real shockers in the, like, I remember writing not long ago that romantic comedy was basically the most doomed genre that there was. There's just been they're just awful. Whereas this, I was thinking, oh, you know, this could be the current generations When Harry Met Sally. You know how we those of us of a certain age, watched that when it came out and thought, wow, this is like, this is just a fantastic romantic comedy. It's like the perfect example of it. I can imagine that there'll be people who look at this and go, yep, this is the one for me. This is because it is satisfying. You do root for these characters, and David O. Russell does a really, really good job of pulling all those strings to make it happen in the end. I just wished that it didn't have the pretensions of sort of indie drama around it, the gritty cinematography, and it just feels to me like it's writing checks that it can't cash, you know, or it doesn't cash at the end. So, but I was certainly satisfied by it on that sort of almost the classic Hollywood level. But yeah, if you go expecting it to be bigger and more meaningful, then you will be disappointed, which is perhaps what happened to me.
Two words, Dan the Man.
Oh boy. Oh, my two words would probably be silver lining.
That's mine. I already wrote it down.
There you go.
Sorry.
Think fast, Kelly. Think fast.
Shouldn't have thrown to me first. Yeah. This is
dang it. Well, I think I've stolen many of yours before.
Okay.
My two words for Silver Linings Playbook, which I'm going to make up right now, are satisfying movie. I don't know. I really enjoy it.
Best two words ever.
Oh, yeah. This is what you get when you get volunteers just wandering into the studio off the street.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's right. That's
okay.
Right.
So this is going to be interesting to see, because it was in Sneaks last weekend, wasn't it? And opens properly on Thursday.
Tomorrow it opens.
And be very interesting to see how it plays out. It is massively competitive, isn't it?
It is hugely.
I mean, what else have we got opening tomorrow?
Zero Dark Thirty. I mean, that's the thing. You know, like, you've got Zero Dark, Silver Linings,
Anna
Karenina. You had Django last week. You've got, which I think,
Hansel and Gretel.
Well, that's
witch
right. Oh, Hansel and Gretel witch hunters. I tell you, the Joker in the pack for me, I think the one to really look out for is Mount Zion when it comes out on the 6th of February.
Trailer's great.
Mm.
Yeah, you've seen it, haven't you?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the trailer is great and plays really well.
Yeah,
plays really well. And it's particularly if so, I would say that if Silver Linings does well and Mount Zion is playing in front of it, which it really should be in terms of the trailer.
That's
then
right.
I think it'll get a really good head start.
Oh, yeah, no, it's been trailering a wee while now. So
can we get anyone on the show for Mount Zion?
We are working on that.
Do we get Stan Walker?
Well,
have a sing-off. I'll take him down.
Yeah. We shall see. We're working on that.
Dance off. No.
New Zealand filmmakers have been very supportive of Cinematica, and we have been in return. So let's watch this space, basically. And that is our show for this week. Next week, yes, indeed, the heavy hitters. We're going to be talking about Hitchcock as well as Zero Dark Thirty and Anna Karenina. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget you can click subscribe in iTunes to make sure that the episodes get downloaded automatically every Thursday morning. You can, on your jog or your commute, you can be listening to us. Thanks very much to everybody who's been giving us feedback and listens weekly. It's just fantastic to know that you're out there. How can people communicate with us, Kaylee? You're our social media guru.
Yes, they can find us on Twitter with our Twitter handle @CinematicaCast, on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast, and on our website at www.cinematica.co.nz. And I would just like to say hello and thank you to all of our new Facebook friends and subscribers, and also a big thanks to Rudy Six. He's been like pushing us and promoting us and pimping us out to his friends and getting us new listeners. So thank you for your tireless efforts on Twitter.
I'm hoping that we'll get a whole lot more Australian listeners as well, thanks to Robert Catto moving to Sydney, because he's a big fan of the show. So thanks very much for him and what he's been doing. This show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music was 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, which you can buy at the iTunes store. We're going to leave you with some more music. David O. Russell seems to be the only director around who can get a license to use Led Zeppelin music in his films. They always say no, but for The Fighter they said yes, and he's managed to do it again. There's a fantastic scene actually in Silver Linings Playbook which features this from Led Zeppelin, What Is and What Should Never Be from Led Zeppelin 2. Until next week, that's all from me.
And me.
And me.
So if you wake up with the sunrise and all your dreams are still as new, and happiness is what you need, so play.